You're listening to the RightStream Radio Network, rejoicing in the flow of creativity. Be sure to follow us on Twitter at RightStream and hashtag RightStream. Thanks for listening to the RightStream Radio Network.
Welcome to this.
And we're having some technical issues today. Try that again.
Welcome to the Speculative Fiction Cantina with your host, S. Evan Townsend.
And welcome. I apologize for technical problems. This is the Speculative Fiction Cantina, your weekly hypodermic injection of science fiction, fantasy, horror, alternate history, and all things weird and wonderful in the world of books and writers. I am your host, S. Evan Townsend. I have 5 published science fiction and fantasy novels, and I recently signed a contract for a 6th. To learn more about me, go to my website, www.sevantownsend.com. That's www.sevantownsend.com. Today on the Speculative Fiction Cantina, we are pleased to welcome writers Laura Enright and Anthony... Metivier. I'm going to screw it up. Say your name, Anthony.
It's Metivier.
Metivier. I apologize for that. Yeah. If you'd like to speak with either of our guests or have a question, please call 347-945-7246. Since I messed that up, I'll do it again. 347-945-7246. Press 1. That tells me you want to go on the air, and I will put you in the queue, and we'll talk to you when we get a chance. And if you'd like more information on our authors, it's on my blog at blog.s7townsend.com, or you can go to my website, s7townsend.com, and click the blog link, or you can Google S. Evan Townsend, and my website should be the first thing that comes up. We have book links there, full bios, links to their websites, all sorts of things that you might be interested in. So, again, welcome, Anthony and Laura.
Hi, Evan. How are you doing?
Anthony. Doing good. Doing good. Anthony.
Yeah.
I was very interested in the title of this novel, Lucas Parks and the Download of Doom, especially considering what happened with Sony recently. Can you tell us about Lucas Parks and the Download of Doom?
Well, it's a story about a kid named Lucas Parks who's downloading the wrong stuff at the wrong time, and he downloads something that ends up infecting him, and someone from the future comes to protect him and teach him the ways of the world that he's just discovered through the download of doom that he's brought into his life. And it's a coming-of-age adventure in many ways, with a kind of guide figure, Yoda figure, who takes the young person through everything that he needs to know to survive in this new world.
So he downloads something and it infects him, not his computer.
Yeah, exactly. It's sort of as if the computer exists specifically to infect humans rather than to infect computers.
Oh, interesting. That's very clever. That's very original. Laura,
Hi.
You have a novel called To Touch the Sun.
I do.
And it's urban fantasy, correct?
Yeah. Horror, urban fantasy.
Yeah, tell us about that.
It's a vampire novel, and it concerns a young man who, back in during World War I, he went to serve in the trenches in France. He's from India. He was hoping to stay on so that he could learn the art of cooking and European cooking. And he's wounded, and he's attacked by what I created as feral vampires. There are 2 forms of vampires, sentient and feral. Feral are sort of the ones who hibernate, and then when something really bad comes up, like a war, they'll come up from the ground and just feast, basically. The other type of vampire is a sentient who can move about in society without a problem. They have certain restrictions, for example, the daylight, but you wouldn't necessarily know that they are vampires. He becomes infected with this condition, and he's the sentient vampire. So through flashbacks, we learn how he's navigated through life adjusted to this new condition, thanks in part to a woman that he meets named Sophie and falls in love with. And she helps him, she actually helps him achieve his goals because she's willing to have him feed off her. So that takes care of, he doesn't have to kill to feed. So that takes care of a lot of the issues that he has had prior to that. The novel takes place in present-day Chicago, so a lot of this is told through flashbacks. And he's reached a crossroads. Sophie, they met in the 30s, so she was very old, but she contracted cancer, and she died the year before. He's gone through the blood that she stockpiled for him, and so now he's faced with having to, again, go back to this life that he was able to put aside when he met her. And he is now a famous restaurateur. He has a business partner who knows what he is. Is sort of a Dom Amato is sort of his liaison with the light, sort of. If he loses control, it's going to be bad for himself and his business partner. But if he doesn't feed, he runs the risk of becoming a feral mentality himself. So he's now. He now has to make a serious choice whether he wants to go back to that life he was leading as far as feeding.
Oh, very interesting. Anthony, do you have another novel? And again, the title interested me a lot. The Tupperware Blitzkrieg?
Yeah.
Is that correct?
That's what it's called, yeah.
Well, tell us about that, please.
Well, it's from a long time ago, and it's definitely sci-fi related, but it's, I wrote it when I was living in New York, and it's about a lot of things. Basically, there's a conspiracy of plastic surgeons who have decided that the American president needs to be replaced, and so they capture him, and they tattoo his skin green, and they bolt the times of the Statue of Liberty's crown into his head, and they start to do all this stuff like political comedy on everything. And Jesus has gotten through, and he has brought the Statue of Liberty, and she is really not happy about that. So she starts going in rampage, almost like Godzilla. And it's a bit of a commentary on some of the things that were going on between 2000 and 2009. And at the end of the day, the Statue of Liberty has to be taken down the way you have to take down Godzilla, and they place the president in where she used to stand. And it's a pretty strange novel, but it came out of a particular context. And living in New York, you are bound to write strange things.
Okay. Anthony, if you could just speak up a little bit, that would be helpful. Laura, is the son a part of a series?
Yes, it is. While I was looking for a publisher for this novel, I enjoyed what I created so much. I hadn't expected to actually write a vampire novel, but I liked the result so much that I just blew right into at this point, I've written four novels in the series plus a spin-off novel featuring two characters that appear in the third novel.
Wow.
So the ideas just kept coming. I was really literally surprised because I wrote the novel hoping to impress an agent that I'd been in touch with, and that fell through. I had really good conversations with him. He liked my work, but he didn't necessarily think what I sent, the novels I had proposed to him would be saleable. So I looked on his website and I saw that he had, his agency represented vampire novels. I liked reading some vampire novels. They were interesting. I wasn't that into the genre, but I thought, I'll give it a try. Sometimes, as you know, when you're a writer, you kind of have to try a lot of things. So I gave it a try, and I just, it was so interesting to build this sort of world or characters and things like that, and I just couldn't stop telling the stories after that.
I know that feeling. I wrote a series, an urban fantasy series, and I was going to stop at two books, and there's now four.
Yeah. It's like it just flows. I've never had anything. I mean, I've written other novels before, but I've never had anything that the stories that just flowed like that. And you want to tell people about all these characters that you write.
Yeah, I also think you have an interesting take on the whole vampire trope. You've got something a little different. It's not your standard seduction vampires. You got the feral vampires and the sentient vampires. That's an interesting take on that.
I wanted to address what it would be like. It's almost, in my mind, it was almost like a chronic condition, and what you have to, even though there are some restrictions, there are some positive things, what you have to, it's like when you have diabetes or MS or something affect your life, and you have to adjust your life to it. So it's kind of like that's sort of how I looked at it when I started writing.
Interesting. Anthony, you also write nonfiction?
Yeah, absolutely. That's one of my great passions is the memory field. And so I've got a lot of books on using your mind to memorize just about anything that you would like for getting an advantage in your profession or in your studies or whatever the case may be, learning a language. So that's a huge part of what I do.
Interesting. Can you teach us a real quick memory trick?
Yeah, sure. If you don't mind me mentioning it, my main website has some longer lessons. It's magneticmemorymethod.com. And actually, if you go to magneticmemorymethod.com/SF, then you can get an audiobook sample of the Lucas Parks on the download, do the whole first chapter. But in terms of memory techniques, there's really something very simple you can do, which is to use your home. And if you were just to think about your kitchen, for example, and you have a fridge and a sink and a counter, and if you were to see those places in your mind, and you don't necessarily have to see them, but just think about where they are, you could leave information on them by creating an image that encodes that information that you wanted to memorize. And to make that even more simple for yourself, you could make a rhyme that goes along with a number. So a very classic one is 1 is a gun, 2 is a shoe, 3 is a flea, and you go through the numbers. So now if you imagine on your fridge there's always a gun, and in your sink there's always a shoe, and on your counter there's always a flea, like a giant flea, then you can link stuff to those locations, right? So if you needed to remember the word triskaidekaphobia, then you could have like a triskaid being shot by a gun, or a gun that's shooting triskaids and shooting it at a deck of cards, triskaidekta, and phobia, maybe the deck of cards is afraid of heights, right? And that's on your fridge. And then you just go to the next piece of information and the next piece of information. But to give you a simpler example, if you met a guy named Tom, and you could just see Tom Cruise, you know, shooting a gun at a sailboat or something like that. And you can memorize a lot of stuff just with that simple technique. And there's so much more you can do that it's incredible. Thousands of words, for example, if you're learning a new language or terminology for a profession and so forth.
Interesting. That's an interesting technique.
Can
Laura,
I ask a question, Evan?
Sure.
Of Anthony? I'm just curious, after what you said, is that kind of where you why you were inspired to write the novel, the current novel, regarding a boy being downloaded with a virus like that? Is that memory?
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff going on like that. I worked as a story consultant for quite some time.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the people that I've worked with in my memory work, he said to me, because he knew that I had done the story consulting work, and I have two books on screenwriting. I was a film professor for many years, and so I have some books on screenwriting and from my work as a story consultant. And he said, when are you going to put together like a movie about memory palaces and about memory techniques? And I thought about it, and so I started to sketch something. And, so the whole idea of downloading something into your mind is exactly what ends up happening in the book, is the kid is taught how to use his mind in exactly these ways, to build spaces where he can get certain powers developing for himself to fight these downloads. And you know, it's also kind of a comment on what's happening in the world right now, because we, at this precise moment that everybody is relegating their memory to devices, we have a renaissance in memory techniques and the natural abilities of our imagination to store large amounts of data. So, you know, I'm not the only person who's doing memory training, but in any case, there's this big movement with Moonwalking with Einstein and the World Memory Championships, all happening at this moment where you can store gazillion Kindle books on your phone. And I was challenged, you know, when are you going to take your memory work into fiction? We know you write novels, and we know that you have this background in story consulting, and some of those movies actually got made. So why don't you do something with it? And a novel came out instead of a screenplay. It connects in both literal and figurative ways, for sure.
That's very interesting. Thank you, Laura, for asking that question. Laura, I want to ask you, when is your next book coming out?
Well, I've sent the sequel to the publisher. I'm hoping he'll get back to me soon. It was fairly recently I sent it, to see if he wants to carry on with the series. It's a small indie publisher, so he's gotten the bag to publishing, and he's gotten a number of projects. So it's, you know, it's, as we all know, sometimes you have to have something to pay the bills, and that takes time away from the projects that you want to work on. So I haven't heard back from him yet, but hopefully he'll get back to me soon. I'm also working on a nonfiction project with a man in Chicago whose father was wrongfully accused of being a loan shark in the 1960s in Chicago. It was the first loan sharking case that the city had seen. And it's a compelling story. It's a really compelling story. So that's involving a lot of research right there. As far as, like, definite dates, I don't have any definite dates on any of the stuff. But
okay. So I want to... Yeah. I want to ask both of you this question, because you both do write nonfiction and fiction. Is it hard to make the transition from fiction to nonfiction, Anthony?
Well, not really. I mean, not for me. I understand storytelling rules fairly well, and that's not to say that I'm a master of them or anything like that, but I sort of write to the patterns, basically, that are classic storytelling patterns. And when I write nonfiction, I try to just write in a very conversational way, and I tell a lot of stories. I have a newsletter that has, you know, been sent out thousands of times, and they're primarily story based. And, you know, to communicate memory techniques through story is something that I'm well practiced in, because I did it every day for almost 3 years now. So they're not really different, and nonfiction is never far from a story anyway, and we have a lot of great nonfiction in the tradition going back over 100 years of you know, immersion journalism, where people are actually writing nonfiction in the form of a story, so it's not difficult at all.
Okay. How about you, Laura? Do you find it easy or difficult to make the transition?
You know, it depends. I was primarily into fiction writing all my life. And when I did the nonfiction, the first book was Chicago's Most Wanted, it was really something I did just so that I could get my foot in the door with a publisher that my friend had given me. And so it was an experience. It was quite a wild experience, because I had never done anything like that before. Once I did it, I found it really, you know, when, after it's accomplished and you don't have to worry about missing deadlines and everything, I found it really thrilling to write. So it really got me into nonfiction as well, later with Vampires Most Wanted and now with this. The difference, I think, that I find, or the hard part I think I find, is for me there has to be a slight different voice, a slightly different voice with nonfiction. There's certainly more research involved. There's a little more of a with fiction you can build your own world. You can create your own issues and your own, you know, solutions and such. With nonfiction, you have to be careful to get the story right, or at least I find it's very important to get the story right. And it's also you're trying to, like with this new project I'm working on, I want to get the story right not only for the for history, but also for this man I'm working with who's you know was very wounded by what happened to his father, and I also want to present it so that people can truly understand all the aspects of it. And there are a lot of aspects to this particular project. You can't completely blame the feds who were a little too crazed in their prosecution because they're trying to clean up the city. You can't blame his old man because, you know, there's sympathy there. So it's like there's a lot of angles sometimes to a fiction story that you have to, a nonfiction story that you have to be very, I think, a little more careful attending to than you would in a fiction story, if that makes sense.
That makes sense. I actually do freelance writing, nonfiction freelance writing sort of feature stories on people. And because of where I live, they tend to be farmers. But it's very interesting. It's a transition. It's a different voice. And it's a different, and it, you know, you can't make stuff up.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, and some people do, but I don't.
Some people
think
that. Do. Yeah, that's true. But I don't. I try to be as accurate as I possibly can.
Mm-hmm.
Anthony, you have another book that's coming out. I don't know when. Called Electville.
Yeah, actually, I prepared a chapter for the listeners if they want to go and check out magneticmemorymethod.com/SF. And so there's the first chapter is there as well as an audio reading of it. And it's also connected to memory. It takes place in sort of like a future version of Berlin where the Berlin Wall was not only never torn down, but it actually was, well, it has become a biological organism that builds itself. And it sort of reversed the logic of East and West Berlin. So instead of people wanting to get out of East Berlin, there's been a sort of lottery that's created that encourages people to try to get in through this wall. And so there's these different camps that are trying to get in, and there's an actual culture inside of the wall, and if it is in the future, people have been robbed of technology outside of the wall, and all the technology is in this East Berlin sort of area, and someone, basically, the protagonist has the dream that her son will become the man who tears down the wall and liberates all of the people on the outside so that they can have some of the technology on the inside, and her dreams are prophetic, and she's absolutely convinced that this is going to be the case. So she does everything in her power to try to get herself into the city, which is not really East Berlin, but it's sort of based on that concept. And it's called Electville, of course. And she wants to give birth to her son there because she's convinced that he will be the man who opens Electville up to all the people on the outside who have no access to technology or anything like that. And, well, you'd have to read it to see whether she is successful or not, but it's quite a chore to try and get in through this wall of Electville.
I bet. Well, so do you have a date when that's coming out?
It should be in February, but the production of the full audiobook is a little bit delayed at the moment, so hopefully it'll be in February.
Okay, great. Good to hear that. Laura, well, you already mentioned this book. I wanted to ask you about it. Vampires Most Wanted?
Mm-hmm.
Is that,
yeah.
Was that fiction or nonfiction?
That was nonfiction.
That was for
the same publisher that put out Chicago's Most Wanted, which is another nonfiction book. That was the first book that I did.
So what were the most wanted vampires?
It's a listing of each chapter is devoted to a different thing, like movies and books and plays, things like that. And then I have in each chapter 10 items, and I do like a little history of them. So, for example, in the books or in the movie section, I would do Dracula and Let the Right One In and et cetera. And then I'd have like a little kind of like a short history of each movie. And it was fun to do. It was just, that's why I mean a lot of research on that as well. And watched a lot of vampire movies.
I was going to say, you probably had to watch every vampire movie out there.
Watch and read. And I mean, it's really amazing how far the genre extends. And there's a chapter on kids vampires. There's a chapter on,
wow,
you know, the movies and the books. And I was surprised that there were plays and musicals. And of course, legends and myths, things like that. I found it a fun chapter called it was Kryptonite, Vampire Kryptonite, and it's, you know, it addresses the crosses and the garlic and, you know, where the idea that those would hurt a vampire, where those ideas might have come from.
Well, that's very interesting. I read somewhere, this is a long time ago, that garlic thins your blood, so maybe that's why vampires don't want garlic.
Yeah. There's a I forget what the ingredient is called, but there's a drug in the garlic that I think affects people with blood issues, in fact, and affects other people. So, you know, just stuff like that could have led to some of these legends being created.
Oh, okay. Anthony.
Mm-hmm.
I heard a big bang. I wasn't sure you're still with us. What other authors inspire you?
Oh, all kinds. I really was influenced by Ballard, J.G. Ballard, when I was a kid. And I really loved Piers Anthony and Robert Asprin, I think, was a really great fantasy writer. The myth series that he had. And I'm also just inspired by writing in general. The whole production of language in print is just absolutely fascinating. So I'm also inspired by experimental poets and people who treat language as a kind of an object and they manipulate it from different angles. Like a former professor of mine, Christian Book, is doing something now called the Xenotext Project. And that is actually encoding organisms with poetry. And, I mean, it sounds insane, but somehow he's figured out this way to encode poetry somehow into an organism and then actually mutate and cause the different poetry things to sort of cross-fertilize and then study what comes out on the other end in terms of is it legible verse? And you have to look it up. It's called the Xenotext Project, and it's just absolutely nuts that he's gotten legitimate government grants to inject living cells with poetry and cause them to populate with each other. And so, and he's, you know, he's a professor of poetry, and he's actually taking language and literature and putting it into science to create the most amazing things. So I'm really, really inspired by that kind of thing that's going on, and it's connected to writing and literature in the most out on the most amazing sci-fi horizons, and yet still connected with what you would call high art, you know, highbrow snobby poetry cults. So it's really, really interesting and inspiring, I think.
Interesting. Laura, what authors inspire you?
Right now, Ken Follett, I think, is fantastic. His Pillars of the Earth series, and I love the Century Trilogy. What I've read of it, I've only gotten through the first book and then half of the second one. I ran out of time. But I think he's amazing what he does, being able to juggle all those characters and all those situations and things like that. One of the authors that I've always been into science fiction and fantasy, one of the authors that I truly, truly loved was Harry Harrison. His Stainless Steel Rat series was just fantastic. And I loved the ability to add humor to that. And it's another reason I liked Douglas Adams as well. They have this incredible way to add humor to what could be kind of a bland story or what have you. And recently I read a book called The Martian by Andy Weir, which was just fantastic. I cheat a little. I don't read it. I listen to it on CD, which can be wonderful in itself. And the reader, R.C. Bray, was just wonderful. I mean, I was thoroughly engrossed. And this is a book that I think could have been a little too full of minutia, but it wasn't at all. I was just so engrossed in this book, so I really like that. But I do like science fiction and fantasy, but I do enjoy a little humor in it as well.
Yeah, I read The Stainless Steel Rat, and I think I've read everything Douglas Adams ever wrote except for his laundry list. Because, you know,
which would probably be hilarious.
Which were probably hilarious, yes. All right. We'll be back with our guests, Laura Enright and Anthony Mativier, in a few moments.
Sunday evenings at 7 o'clock Eastern, tune in to Right Stream Radio Network for Just Believe with author and metaphysician Lisa Tarvis. Lisa interviews experts in the areas of health and wellness, alternative healing, paranormal phenomena, intuitive guidance, and positive living. With her own inimitable down-to-earth style, Lisa makes both guests and callers welcome and appreciated. Just Believe with Lisa Tarvis, Sunday evenings at 7 o'clock Eastern, 6 Central, here on the Right Stream Radio Network.
You're listening to the Speculative Fiction Cantina on Right Stream Radio.
And we're back. It's time for our science story of the day. And today's science story is about a Japanese spacecraft that has been launched on a very ambitious mission to actually blast a hole in an asteroid and return samples of space rock to Earth. And this is a Japanese word, Hayabusa 2. Will use an ion engine to catch up with its prey, which is asteroid 1999 JU3. The asteroid is a C-type carbonaceous asteroid, which could have water and organics. And as humanity spreads into space, hopefully someday, we're going to need water and organics that we're not going to have to pull from Earth, because pulling stuff from Earth is very expensive and energy intensive. The target rendezvous is 2018. And the ship will orbit the asteroid for 18 months, landing 3 times to pick up material. And it's about the size of an armchair, this spacecraft, not counting its solar panels. And while it studies the asteroid from orbit, it'll deploy 3 rovers and a German-European lander called Mascot, all of which will work independently on the surface to gather information on the asteroid's composition and history, so we can learn more about our solar system that we live in. And if you'd like to read the complete story, there's the link to that on my blog, on the post about this show. And, of course, my blog is, as always, blog.s7townsend.com. We are back with our writers, Laura Enright and Anthony Mativier. Again, if you'd like to talk to either of them or ask a question, the number is 347-945-7246. That's 347-945-7246. Laura, I want to ask you, why did you start writing?
I liked it. That's a simple answer, isn't it? You know, I don't really know. I think it was just because it's been so long. I just really like to tell stories, I guess. Love to read, always love to read a variety of things. And it was fascinating to watch how the authors presented their stories. So I think I was always very good at daydreaming too. So So I think that has something to do with it, you know, in line at a grocery store or something. I can be telling stories in my head and complete scenes and everything. So I don't know. I started when I was 12, and I think it was also this sounds pathetic. I was also a lonely child. And I had kind of a rough childhood with my family, so I think that helped me helped me focus on other things as opposed to the weirdness in my family.
Interesting. Anthony, why did you start writing?
Well, you know, I don't really know why, but I do remember when. And that was in grade four. They sat me in front of a computer, and there were keys in front of me, and they had ledgers, and other people were just typing certain things for the assignment, and I just started to write a story. I remember the story very well, and it just went on from there. And that was grade four, and then by grade six, I had won some kind of short story contest and went up to the university in the city and had pizza with a major Canadian author who was hosting this, or he was major at the time, anyway. And it was really, really, maybe that's what made it continue or not, but I think I probably would have continued anyway because I think I really just fell in love with typing more than anything else. And I've always had a huge pleasure in typing.
Great, thanks. Well, it's time to do our readings. Laura, do you have a reading for us?
I do.
All right.
I've chosen is it takes place after one of the flashbacks in which Narain tells his dad that he has enlisted in the army, and his dad, of course, is not overly happy with that. And it takes place in present day Chicago at a fundraiser, and it introduces the new love of his life, Cassie, who he meets at this fundraiser. So, Narain Khan blinked back to the present, shaking his head slightly. He did not know what had caused thoughts of his father and that conversation to come unbidden to his mind. That strip of memory had taken place so long ago that it seemed almost unreasonable for it to be pestering him now as he stood near a sweet table in the winter garden of Chicago's Harold Washington Library, watching glimmering North Shore faces mingle amongst themselves. The Max Baldorni Orchestra played a passionate rendition of that old black magic as people glided along on the dance floor or swayed to the music while networking in tightly packed groups. The fifth annual Reach for the Cure benefit for leukemia research had proven to be great success, and the moments that Narain had been able to focus on the present and not zone back to the past, he had found it quite enjoyable. He dutifully performed the rounds of publicity Don had arranged, making the statements, taking pictures, shaking the hands of the city's elite, Chicago personalities, and politicians, and even the mayor himself. Generally sociable by nature, Narain possessed a playfulness that his sweet Sophie had managed to reignite decades ago after those dead years following a painful trip home to India and an aborted attempt to reunite with his family. He so often regretted not going through with contacting them, but how would they ever understand what he had become on that battlefield when he didn't understand it himself? He had returned to Europe after visiting his boyhood home, shattered in mind and spirit, existing by chance, not by choice, until he had met Sophie, and she helped him face life again, life such as it could be with a strained condition. She would have liked his gala, and any other night he would have taken some elderly Chicago socialite for a spin on the dance floor in Sophie's memory, pretending that the woman he was holding was the woman who had saved his soul so many decades before. Considering his current state and need, though, he felt it best to remain distant. The room was ripe with the warm, exhilarating scent of human life and echoed with the sound of racing pulses that called to his very core, and occasionally he found his vision blurring as he nearly lost himself to the sensation. There were moments, in fact, when the instinctual urge to lower his fangs overwhelmed him, and he had to fight to stay focused. He was perhaps being too stubborn. The fangs tucked behind the canines could be brutal weapons or precision instruments, depending on the need. After the transformation, it had taken weeks for the fangs to come in, as the structure of his entire mouth naturally adjusted to better fit the new dental anatomy. A few back molars fell out. There was no need for chewing. And his upper and lower jaw elongated slightly to provide a better bite radius. It was a change imperceptible to anyone else, but Narain knew the change had occurred. The dull, constant ache lasted for weeks, the memory of it lasting even longer. When he used his fangs for the first time, it both startled and disturbed him how natural they fit as they slid down and allowed him to puncture the thick hide of the horse he'd chosen to feed off of. Nearly a century later, he could glide through the crowd like a snake, mesmer people with a curious breath technique that had developed with his new life, and pierce the delicate flesh so quickly and cleanly that the host need never know that such a violation had occurred. Narain had been walking that path the night he met Sophie, and when they discovered that Sophie could offer the sustenance he needed without fear of returning, he refused to go that route ever again. He remained grateful he still had the strength to refuse. Dom was right. Narain had to do something soon. It had been too long since he had the sustenance he required, and the time would come when his body would rebel and make a decision for him. It had happened before, and he couldn't let it happen again. "I enjoyed your spicy cashews." A voice scattered his thoughts, and he turned to see a woman standing next to him, sipping a drink and glancing up at him coyly, fully realizing the innuendo she just spoke. Her long brunette hair was swept up in a stylishly haphazard fashion, and strings of it draped across her bare shoulders. She wore a clingy black cocktail dress and an elegant necklace that hung loosely a few inches below her neck, its small teardrop diamond resting comfortably just above her cleavage. Her features had a rosy fullness to them, with the slightest of underbites that gave her face an attractively determined look. What really struck him, however, were her eyes, a crystal blue that twinkled with a zest he hadn't seen since Sophie. How often had he lost himself in the depths of Sophie's eyes, never caring if he ever reemerged. "But then," she continued, "I imagine few women would forget your cashews." Raising an eyebrow, he grinned, replying, "I've also satisfied a few men in my time." She laughed huskily, the ice cube she was sucking falling back in her glass, in a move he found refreshingly uninhibited. "Well, that was fun," she giggled. "I wonder how long we could have kept that up." "I once kept it up for 2 days," he said, looking out over the crowd, then realizing the implication, this time unintentional. His head turned quickly toward her as he clarified awkwardly, "I mean a conversation is what I kept up." She laughed at his fumbling, and he smiled wide, focusing her full attention on him. She switched her glass to her left hand, holding out her right. "My name is Cassandra. Cassie, if you like." Taking her hand, he felt a curious warmth spread through him. He usually felt something when he shook the hands of others, but he had trained himself to be indifferent to the sensation, since it often seemed so very predatory. This time he allowed the alluring warmth to spread up his arm and fill his body, manifesting itself in a slight glaze to his eyes. It had nothing to do with his current hunger. It was much more. She had a strong, steady pulse that complemented her playful essence. While he yearned to be lost in that essence, he knew better and released her hand, returning to the present. "My name is Narain," he said. "Yes, I know who you are. You're responsible for this delicious feast." "Ah, yes," he grinned, "the spicy cashews. I'm glad you enjoyed the food." "It was nice of you to donate your services." "Donate?" he shut out. "Nobody told me I was donating." When she realized that it was a put-on, she burst out with another round of giggles that entranced him even further. He was enjoying the flirtation. Sophie had taught him how to feel comfortable with flirting again, but since then he had only been interested in flirting with her. With Sophie gone, the desire seemed to leave him. He was glad to find out that it had been a temporary loss. "Tell me, Narain, do chefs dance? And if so, would you care to?" Smiling, he nodded. "They do, and I would."
Oh, very descriptive. The description of the woman, she was very visual, very...
Oh, nice.
I could picture her. So thank you for sharing that with us.
Oh, thanks for letting me do that.
Sure. Now, Anthony, we're doing something a little different that we normally don't do. We have a clip from your audio book. Do you want to introduce this?
It's from Lucas Park, from the Download of Dune, from where Lucas meets the guy who's going to teach him how to deal with these vows that are called that are being downloaded, and one of which infects him. And Ron Phillips does a really, really great narration in the audiobook, and he just nails the character of the person who guides Lucas Parks through this new universe. So I'm really, really happy for people to get to hear just his narration alone, because it's so fantastic.
Okay, here we go.
Then he was back in the chair in the office, staring at the locked computer with nothing to do. Outside, the empty highway cracked beneath the cold. Lucas studied its snow-frosted surface, lit by the gas station lights and snarling at him, daring him to come out for a walk. He twirled back and forth in the office chair as he looked fixedly through the window above the computer monitor. His own reflection shot back at him on both glass surfaces, an unhappy, bored face, the face of an internet pirate in chains and shackles. Suddenly, the monitor came on. Lucas watched, utterly stunned, as the password field filled itself. He studied his hands where they were still parked in his lap. It had not been Lucas who had entered the password. As the desktop booted up, Lucas stared in wonder. It was not the normal desktop he was familiar with, the gaudy photo of Martin's family with their retarded son on the beach in Maui. He gawked instead at a strange emblem laid beneath a field of unusual alien icons. "What the hell?" he muttered, reaching for the mouse. "Whoa!" Lucas heard a voice say from across the counter. He snapped his head and saw a man in a white cowboy hat. He had a long white mustache that was broken on the right side by a protruding toothpick. "I wouldn't touch that mouse if I was you, son." Lucas flinched at being called son for the second time that night, but the mouse under his hovering hand caught his attention as the warm tendrils growing up from the wet plastic touched his palm. "What the... Hey!" he shouted at the man as the mouse crawled against the skin of his palm. "What is this?" Lucas shoved himself back in the chair and stared at the writhing mouse in terror. And now the monitor was warping too, the screen forming into a mouth with digital glass teeth. Although terrified, Lucas was also entranced. He found it difficult to look away. "You best come out here and get away from that computer," the man replied. His voice was calm as he slowly withdrew an unusual pistol from inside his long, dark coat. "Well, son, you ain't going to make me shoot you, are you? Be ashamed seeing that you're so young and all." Lucas overcame his shock at the hypnotic transformation of the computer and looked into the barrel of the gun. It was a living thing, writhing as the man leveled it at a point between Lucas's eyes. "Okay," he said. "I'm moving." Lucas cautiously stepped away from the computer and then bolted out of the office as the computer morphed into a body with snarling jaws and a spiked mouse for a tail. The mouse oozed with toxic venom and snapped out at the man's gun, which barked back with a stream of blue fire. As the wounded tail recoiled, it grazed Lucas's face. But before Lucas could fully appreciate the stinging on his cheek, a blue explosion from the man's weapon pushed him back against the cash register. He looked up just in time to see the computer engulfed in flames, clutching at itself, stamping at its burning, melting arms as the tail flailed uselessly. Lucas took his eyes from the growing blue inferno in the office and watched as the man returned the gun to a pocket within his coat. The fire alarm started ringing, but the man snapped his fingers, mysteriously forcing it into silence. "You okay there, son?" "What the hell was that?" Lucas demanded, wiping at his face as the computer toppled onto the floor. "Hold on," the man said. He withdrew another organic device from another pocket. Stepping behind the counter, he aimed the device at the flames. A mouth opened and inhaled the corpse of the computer, the poisonous tail giving a final flick before disappearing into the device. Lucas peered into the office. Martin's computer was gone. A thin trace of blue smoke rising from the clean square on the otherwise dusty desk where the computer had been sitting. "Now then, son," the man said, looking at Lucas with squinty eyes. "What was your question?" "Quit calling me son," Lucas said, "and tell me exactly what just happened." The man pursed his lips. "My, oh my, you're a snappy one, ain't you?" "Whatever," Lucas said. "But that's my boss's computer you just toasted and, I don't know, like vacuumed into some kind of ferret." The man looked at the object in his hand and stroked its fur. "Ferret, huh? I've been looking for a name for this little guy. He's new, you see. Bongo got too fat and old, so I had to put him down. Thanks to you, now I've got a name for my new one. Ferret."
Okay. That was very descriptive also. I could see this computer morphing into a very scary being. So, go ahead.
It's a pretty scary thing to see a computer turning into some kind of creature, I can imagine.
Yes. Yeah. And the mouse trying to grab you and then turning into a tail. And very, very interesting and very descriptive. Laura, I want to ask you, you say you've been writing since you were 12. What do you love about writing?
I think creating the story. Well, with the fiction, it would be creating the universes, the characters, things like that. With the nonfiction, it's just, I love the research. I really fell in love with the research. When I did Chicago's Most Wanted, I wasn't aware I would get into it that much, but it was just fantastic. So kind of two different answers on depending on whether it's fiction or nonfiction. But it's, sometimes you can have a lot of fun researching things for fiction as well. I have a Asian dragon fantasy novel that I'm putting the finishing touches on that it's not China, but it's based on China, so I had to do some research on that. So yeah, I just love telling the stories, getting the information out there.
Yeah, yep, I agree. Anthony, what do you love about writing?
Oh, I think writing is the closest thing to alchemy that we have. You can take one thing and transform it into another just by casting a few simple spells with words.
Can I quote you on that? That's brilliant. I love that description.
His answer was quicker and classier than mine.
Yeah, that was a great answer. Laura, do you have like a writing ritual? You have to be in the same spot. You have to have the right music. You have to wear the same shirt. Is there anything that helps put you in the mood to write?
Not really. My big problem now is finding the time to write. So, you know, I can write these scenes in my head, and I think that's one reason that I'm able to do it now. Like I said, while standing in line at a store or something, it's finding the time to write them down. I'm lucky I can remember them as well as I can. But as far as I know, I remember reading something with Stephen King saying that, you know, that was one reason he had an office, because he wanted to go to the office, and there was sort of ritualistic thing there where you go to the office and write for 8 hours. And if you're Stephen King, you can do that. Sometimes you can't.
Yeah.
I've just sort of trained myself to write whenever I get the chance and whenever I can. And I don't really worry too much about, I do tend to become a little looser at night. So it's easier. I'm generally a night person. But as far as I write whenever I get the chance or whenever I need to.
Okay, how about you, Anthony? Do you have a writing ritual?
I do, actually. I write first thing in the morning without leaving the bed. I have discovered a great app that I use on my iPhone to compose, and it just hot syncs everything to Dropbox, so nothing is lost. It's instantly saved, and I write typically for about 2 hours or so, and it's just amazing, and I've done that for years now. And I also have the ritual of writing down as many dreams as I can remember. And I actually wrote a book called How to Remember Your Dreams, which has had some popularity. And I go through the different things that you can literally train yourself to remember 6, 7, 8 dreams a night with regularity. And so I practice that as part of a ritual, and it makes it much, much easier to fall into writing fiction or just writing in general, because there's a lot of people think of writing as a creative activity, which it is, but it's also a physical activity, and they go together. So I really don't think of anything existing like writer's block. There's really only thinker's block. But if you can train yourself to just simply write as a physical activity, then you almost always have ideas. So if you throw memory abilities into the mix, Laura, then you can remember anything that you wanted to write and then just physically start writing it, and everything flows together. And it is that kind of thing I was mentioning with alchemy. You can change your state and create change in the states of others. So, yeah, my ritual is basically just to start writing from the first moment I get up and keep writing throughout the day, no matter what I'm doing on my iPhone. And just syncing it to Dropbox and sending it to my editor later. So,
wow,
it's a life of writing.
I can't imagine writing on my iPhone. but I'm very slow on my iPhone.
Yeah, well, I basically, you know, I went to the Thumb Olympics or something, but I can do it really fast with my thumb. I think I write almost just fast enough to keep up with my thoughts. So it works nicely in comparison to typing, where I can type too fast on a keyboard and it just becomes mush. But it's almost like I can type as fast as I speak, so I get a nice rhythm and a nice flow, and there's minimal editing too, because you're concentrating on it. Minimal editing, I mean, on the surface level, in terms of having to change typos because of missing words or misspellings and so forth, because you're so concentrated. And I really recommend it to anyone. It's just called the Plain Text app, and it may be available for other devices as well. And if you try it, I think you'll find that it's a lot easier to write on the iPhone than you would think.
Say the name of that app again.
Plain Text.
Plain text. Oh, interesting. Okay.
I found myself more comfortable writing freehanding, but I think I've been trying to train myself to type more. I think it's more efficient that way. Although you do get a chance to, when you're typing the freehanded work into the computer, you get a chance to edit it. But I just always found it easier to freehand. It flows easier for me.
And I'm a typer. Typing is the only thing that can keep up with how fast my brain works. And I'm a very fast typer. I'm not a very accurate typer, but I'm a very fast typer.
I'm not saying so. I can read what I freehand.
Yeah, that's
frustrating.
So, Laura, do you suffer from writer's block, and how do you overcome it?
I really don't. I don't know if I've ever really suffered. Again, I'm pretty good at working through it, and I'm so excited about when I come up with something, I'm so excited that it flows pretty naturally. So I don't really have that problem. Like I said, the problem I have is finding the chance to sit down and get it all out on paper or in the computer, but it stays in my head. So
yeah, I agree. It's a built-in app on the, comes with the OS on the iPhone, and it's a voice recorder. And I've used that, like you say, you're in the checkout line at the store, and you have an idea. And if I want to make sure I don't forget the idea, I'll record it in that app. I get some strange looks sometimes, but I'll record it in that app. And then when I get home, I'll listen to it, and I go, okay, that's what I was trying to say, and that reminds me of what I was trying to do, because you don't always have something to write with. And sometimes you think, oh, I'll remember this, and you get home, you go, oh, my gosh, what was that? That was a brilliant idea.
Yeah. You're in the shower or something, and you just written the best line ever, and then
And then by the time you dried off, you forgot it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm about to shower. So, Laura, what outside of writing inspires you?
I like music. I've recorded music in the past, just for fun. Had a 4-track back in the day. That's a lot of fun to do, and. Right now it's just trying to get my writing career really, really starting to flow. I like science fiction and fantasy movies and superhero movies and things. I'm a huge Godzilla fan. I enjoy Bollywood too, which is probably why I thought of an Indian vampire. So I have quite a collection. I have a very eclectic collection of DVDs and things like that. Love comedies. So, all sorts of things. I really do. I say that I have way too many interests and not enough time for them all. And it's kind of the truth.
Yeah, I understand that. Anthony, what outside of writing inspires you?
Oh, all kinds of things. I'm a musician myself, and really, just people inspire me. All the amazing things that are happening and that you can know about are happening online. Really a big fan of internet technology and just everything that's going on inspires me. The fact that you're doing this show is inspiring, and using the available means to bring people together and just share ideas and enjoy what was impossible to do, even just within memory. You know, this stuff was never happening 20 years ago, so... It's just all very, very inspiring.
Great. That sounds very interesting. Laura, do you have anything you want to add as we wrap up the show?
Nothing really, except I hope people will, you know, check out the series. And like I said, it's been a very much a labor of love for me. And, you know, see, just visit my website, laura-enright.com, and you'll find some news on me.
Great. Anthony, anything to add as we wrap up the show?
Yeah, I would just say it was a pleasure and an honor, and I look forward to looking at Laura's books. And if anybody wants some free audio and downloads from the Download of Doom, they can go to magneticmemorymethod.com/SF, and there's some good stuff there for you, and just on my main site as well, if you're interested in improving your memory, magneticmemorymethod.com. We've got a 4 free video series that takes you through memory palace construction and gives you everything you need to know to get started. So that would be cool. But I really want to thank you, Evan, for having me on the show.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Yes, I want to thank both of you for being on my show. Wouldn't be possible without writers such as you. And so thanks, Laura Enright and Anthony Metivier. More information on these writers is available on my blog, which is blog.s7townsend.com. And thank you all for joining us.
This has been the Speculative Fiction Cantina on Rightstream Radio.